my Redeemer. Psalm 20. It would appear that Jerusalem is under siege at the time of writing. Those living in the city have assembled in the temple to plead with Yahweh to come to the aid of the king and the army. This next paragraph, I searched yesterday and I searched today, and I cannot find my source for this information, and because I haven't got a lot of available things in a parish, as you'd imagine. I must have got it from somewhere, but I'm capable of confusing things. So I'll offer you this as a possibility, because where I expected to find this information didn't have it, and I haven't can't think where I got it from, because I neglected to put down my source. So this may not be true, but I'll give it to you in case it is. A first century BC Aramaic version of this psalm in Egyptian script, God knows what arcane work I was reading when I found all this out, but it's too long ago for me to be able to locate it, has been discovered, in which the Egyptian god Horus is named where this psalm has Yahweh. And I thought I'd tell you that because it draws out an interesting other thought to have in your mind when you're reading the psalms. As we can borrow songs from other cultures and translate them into English, so there may have been a bit of borrowing going on here. Is this a translation from an ancient Egyptian text in which the psalmist has borrowed and he liked it, and he dropped Horus off and put Yahweh in, possibly? Or did the devotees of Horus in Egypt, because it's Aramaic, so did they borrow it from later Jewish sources? And there were Jews, of course, in Egypt. So one or other of those is a possibility, or I may be telling you something that's not even true, because I can't be sure of it now. But I wouldn't have made it up. So, whatever about that, and it alerts you to a possibility which you need to be remembering. People who are inspired aren't just in an ecstasy. They're intelligent people searching and gathering this and finding meaning in it, and the people in the temple liked it, and maybe they invented it, and the Egyptians liked it. I don't know. Now, anyhow, back to the psalm. A campaign is about to begin, and the king is fighting Yahweh's cause, as they thought, and as we can still think. A pretty balmy idea that God's interested in war and one side winning and not the other side, and everybody praying for victory. And I find that also totally obscure and ridiculous. The king is fighting Yahweh's cause, and nearly everyone who fights a war claims that. And according to the current ideology, a nation's gods were expected to fight at the head of the army. So that's what this is a plea to. God, we're going out to fight. Come with us and make sure we win. Here's an example. In the second book of Chronicles, chapter 32, before we move to the psalm, verse 6 reads, Hezekiah appointed combat commanders over the people and gathered them together to him in the square at the gate of the city and spoke encouragingly to them, saying, Be strong, be of good courage. Don't be afraid or dismayed before the king of Assyria or the horde that is with him, for there is one greater with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh. With us is Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles. Well, that's exactly the mentality behind this quite brief Psalm 20, which begins, May Yahweh answer you in the day of siege. This is the plea of the people in the temple, you meaning the king and the army. May Yahweh answer you in the day of siege. May the name of the God of Jacob protect you. God of Jacob, well, that alerts you to the fact that it's the universal, the God of all the tribes of Israel. So it's a gathering in of the whole 12 tribes. May he send you help from the sanctuary and give you support from Zion. May he remember all your offerings and look with favor upon your sacrifices. And then occurs in many of the Psalms, a little Hebrew word which people aren't quite sure what it means, the Selah. And I suggested to you it probably means, A pause, shouldn't say probably, possibly means a pause in the singing so that the music takes over and people meditate on what's been said up till now to the sound of just music but no words. That's what I suggest to you is likely the meaning of the Sela. Anyhow, he goes on. May he grant your heart's desire and fulfill all your plans. That can be a beautiful prayer. We can still pray that. May God grant all your heart's desires. Hopefully all your desires come from a pure heart or a heart that's on the road of being purified. And fulfill all your plans. Lovely prayer. Why not? But I've given you two other texts. It's a fairly quite uncommon expression in the Hebrew Bible. Here are two other texts where it's quite important. Talking about David. 1 Samuel chapter 13. Yahweh sought out a man after his own heart. And Yahweh appointed him to be ruler over his people. Write the authors of Samuel some 400 and more years after the time of David. So we're dealing with idealization here, of course. But what a lovely expression about David. David is a man after God's own heart. You know, the kind of king that God wants. 2 Samuel, written about the same time, chapter 7, verse 21. O Lord Yahweh, because of your promise and according to your own heart, you have wrought all this greatness so that your servant may know it. So that's the heart of God, meaning God's deepest will and God's deepest intentions and God's deepest desires. Well, David is the one whom God chose. So here, our psalmist is saying, well, if David is the one God chose, David, the king, and now you've got the dynastic king who's inherited the promise, it's praying that God will look after the desires of the heart of the king, just as the king looks after the desires of the heart of God. I presume that's clear enough. And the text goes on in verse 5. May we shout for joy over your deliverance. They're under siege, so this is a defensive war. Good. I wish all wars were, if we have to have them at all. We shout for joy at your deliverance, and in the name of our God, set up our standards. Then comes a little line here, verse 5, the second part, and I suggest to you, because scholars suggested to me, that what it is the president of the assembly pronouncing a favourable oracle. This is the prayer from the people, and then the high priest, comes forth and announces in a prophetic way this line, Yahweh will fulfil all your petitions. Comes, you get the feel of it? From the president in response to the cry of the people. You can't pick that up just reading the psalm. But if you read it carefully, maybe that's a very likely way to read it. It's dramatic, liturgical stuff. And then the response is, the king then says, now I know, because the priest has said it from his prayer, now I know that Yahweh will give deliverance to his anointed, his Messiah, his Messiah, his Christ, that's the Greek word. He will answer him from his holy heaven, with the might of his victorious right hand. Some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we invoke Yahweh, our God. Horses in the Bible always means military power. Horses were nothing to do with sport. The horse was the equivalent of the Sherman tank, and I know they've improved on that, but I don't know the latest names. It was the if you're on horseback, you had much more chance of winning a battle if you had a lot of horse than on foot. So chariots and horses go together, and they always mean battle. Some put their hope in these things. Our hope is in Yahweh, our God. They will collapse and fall. We shall rise and stand upright. Prayer, give deliverance to the king, Yahweh. Answer us as we call upon you. This shout rises from the assembly in support of the petition of the king as the troops prepare to march out to defend their city against the army that is besieging the city. They're praying to be rescued from the attacking army. Well, that's a very straightforward... I'm not saying that was the psalm every time they went to battle, but it may have been. It may have been the hymn they all loved to pray before they went out into the battlefield. We can pray it. We have other battles to fight, obviously.